Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. Now, let's join Dan to discuss this week's episode, Overlord.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Republic Forces Radio Network. Bringing you all that is Star Wars Clone Wars. We're here to talk about the latest episode, Overlords. Joining me this evening is Arnie from Star Wars Action News, now playing the Star Wars Action News bookcast, Books and Nachos, and I'm sure there's something else I've forgotten in there.
Marvelicious Toys, the Marvel Toys collecting podcast that you can find at marvelicioustoys.com. Happy to be here.
I knew there was one more. And also, Boy Everest coming back for this story arc.
Hello, everybody. I'm here to bring balance to this roundtable.
And from Star Wars Fanworks, Nathan P. Butler.
Hello, everybody. We're playing by Pandora rules this time, apparently.
Yes, it would seem so. This episode seems to be a clashing of a lot of different movies, but I'm sure we will get into that.
Is that what the P stands for? Nathan Pandora Butler? You don't want to open his box?
You think his Star Wars timeline's bad. You should see his Avatar timeline. No, wait a minute. That didn't even...
Now, there's different levels of canon with Avatar, you see, with the special edition and the... Oh, never mind.
There is C-level canon for Cameron.
There you go.
All right. We are going to be talking about Overlords, episode 59. I can't believe we're already to 59, and that's not counting the three or four that were the first movie. Season 3, episode 15, production number season 3, episode 9. Our fortune cookie this week, balance is found in the one who faces his guilt. Kind of wondering about how that actually applies, but we'll get into that. Let's go ahead and get our episode summary, and then we'll jump into it. The episode begins with Anakin, Obi-Wan, and Ahsoka being dispatched to investigate a message received with a 2,000-year-old distress signal buried inside of it. Upon arriving at the coordinates of the distress signal, the Jedi find that the Republic cruiser they were supposed to meet, while still at the coordinates, is nowhere to be seen. After a brief power failure, the Jedi are met with the vision of the approaching, for lack of a better word, monolith. Something is pulling their shuttle in. There's a blinding flash of light, and the Jedi awaken to find that their shuttle has landed, yet none of them remember how. They're on a mysterious asteroid-sized organic mass, and though the ship's systems are functioning, nothing works. Fortunately, this mass does have a breathable atmosphere, so they decide to leave the shuttle. What a good idea! Outside the shuttle, the three Jedi meet the daughter, who speaks to them in some rather cryptic terms, asking if Anakin is the one. And when questioned about where they are and who brought them there, she says only that she will take them to him, and that they must get to their destination before nightfall. This doesn't seem like a whole lot of information, but the Jedi follow the daughter anyway. Along the way, they press for little more detail about their destination.
Excuse me. Who are you taking us to?
The father, of course.
Of course.
And what exactly are you?
We are the ones who guard the power. We are the middle, the beginning, and the end.
Glad she cleared that up for us.
As they follow the path, there's a landslide. Obi-Wan and Ahsoka are separated from Anakin and the daughter. Suspecting her brother, the daughter advises Anakin not to leave this place. And though Obi-Wan thinks he and Ahsoka should try to find a way around to meet up with Anakin, Anakin advises them to return to the shuttle, send another distress call.
I'll follow her and find out how to get off this rock.
When they return to where their ship was, Obi-Wan and Ahsoka find it mysteriously missing. Furthermore, they meet the son, who questions them as to why they haven't obeyed his sister's instructions. He then reveals himself to be kind of a dark side kind of guy.
Yes. And no.
after warning that there is an event to come that, no matter how much they don't like it, has to happen, he gives them a little bit of advice.
The storms here are quite lethal. If you want to live, I suggest you find shelter.
As Obi-Wan and Ahsoka rush to find shelter in a nearby cave, Anakin has also found a cave to use for shelter. However, off in the distance, he sees a monastery with a great light above it. Realizing that this must be where someone who can give him answers is, he makes his way there, and we meet the Father. Despite Anakin's demands to know what's going on, the Father puts him off, reminding him only that there is nowhere he can go, and encouraging him to stay the night as his guest. Back in the cave that is their shelter for the night, Obi-Wan gets an unexpected visit.
Obi-Wan, have you done as I asked? Have you trained the boy?
Master Qui-Gon, how are you here?
The Force Spectre of Qui-Gon Jinn advises Obi-Wan that there are beings on this planet that believe that Anakin is the Chosen One, and that with his Force powers, this planet, being of the Force, is a very dangerous place. Elsewhere, Anakin is also having a late-night visit from a vision of his long-dead mother. Anakin's visitation, however, doesn't go as well as Obi-Wan's, and soon the confrontation turns rather ugly, and the vision of his mother turns out to be a large gargoyle, which we know to be the sun's alternate form. Back in the cave, Ahsoka Tu receives a visit from her future self, who warns her that she sees the dark side being planted by Anakin in Ahsoka, and that Ahsoka may not see her future if she remains his student. Back in the monastery, Anakin demands to know what's going on. However, the answer is much more than he expected. Rather than this being a trap of a Sith Lord, the Father reveals himself to be something entirely different. And perhaps Anakin is as well. To find out the truth, he needs to conduct one simple test. In the monastery's arena, Anakin finds the son in his gargoyle form and the daughter in her griffin form have kidnapped Obi-Wan and Ahsoka. And this is the test the Father spoke of. To allow Anakin to remove his guilt and prove that he is the Chosen One, he has to choose which one will live. Anakin, however, doesn't want to play this little game.
Oh, but I think you will.
Telling Anakin that only he has the power to make his children release Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, Anakin gets a little bit of advice from Obi-Wan.
Anakin! The planet is the Force. Use it!
Reaching out in the Force, Anakin forces the gargoyle and the griffin to drop their prisoners, and then, right as they are about to strike, he pulls them together and forces them to kneel before him.
On your knees!
Satisfied, the Father announces that this is what he had hoped to see.
Only the Chosen One could tame both my children.
Anakin now demands that the Father keep his promise and allow them to leave now that he has passed his little test. The Father, however, has one more thing he wants to tell Anakin and orders everyone to leave them alone. Ahsoka has a little bit of parting advice for Anakin before she leaves.
Do not trust him.
You think?
The Father reveals that he is dying, and the prophecy of the Chosen One seems to be that the one chosen to bring balance is bringing balance between his children, the daughter, light side, and his son, the dark side. Only Anakin can take his place once he passes on and keep things in their rightful balance. Anakin, however, doesn't want to stay for, well, fairly obvious reasons. Discouraged by this, the Father tries to persuade him, however, lets him know that he cannot force him, that this must be of his own choice. But the guilt from leaving will be something that haunts him and the galaxy. On the landing platform of the monastery, the Jedi board their shuttle and seem to leave the planet. Okay, before we get into our discussion of the episode proper, let's go around and get everybody's first impressions, general overviews of what we thought of the episode. And Barron, since you've been away for so long, what did you think of Overlords?
Well, my first general impression was, wow. It was great. The visuals were great. Everything was back on track. Everything's back to normal. I mean, the visuals are on par of where it's supposed to be. We had a lot of new visuals here in this episode. Nathan had mentioned Pandora. I had got that right off the bat with the floating rocks, and I don't know if that's intentional, if they were intentionally giving nods to all these different movies, but it's just a welcome change to what we've been getting.
All right. Arnie, what did you think?
You know, I came to this episode like a man in the desert, desperate for a glass of water, because for the past month, you guys have all been enjoying the thirst-quenching juice that was the Savage Opress trilogy. But I have been having just a trickle because I got to experience that back in December. And while it was great to rewatch it, my hunger for new was just growing and growing because Savage Opress was just so freaking good that I wanted the next step, and I had to wait an extra month to get that, and here it was, and my overall thought is that it was good. Now, I kind of dislike these arcs because when I saw Savage Opress, it was a movie, and it played well as a movie. When you guys saw it, it was three separate episodes. Here, I feel like we're kind of in that same boat, where what I'm watching and what we're reviewing tonight feels like one-third of a movie. And so, I kind of liked it, but I have no perspective yet on this arc. I think it was setting up good things, but very rarely could you walk out of a movie a third of the way through and just go, oh man, that movie rocked. You know, the first third is always the setup, and the second third and the third third are the payoffs. So I liked what I got. I'm looking forward to more, but I can't walk away with the same jubilance I had at Savage Opress, where I got it all in one sitting, and then when I rewatched it, I knew what was coming. Here, I have no idea what's coming, but I enjoyed myself watching it, and I'm looking forward to it.
Very descriptive terms in there. I don't know whether I'm excited about the episode or I need a snack.
So. Maybe both.
Maybe, you know, maybe a little bit. Nathan P. Butler, how about you?
You know, this episode, it had a lot of great ingredients to it. You know, we have familiar voice actors returning. We have interesting visual concepts, like the little Taoist-looking symbol that we got. We have some interesting openings for storylines. For instance, the future version of Ahsoka and this whole we're returning to the idea of balance of the Force and what does it mean, bringing Eastern philosophy in and all that. It really had all the ingredients necessary to be a kick-butt episode. But just like when I cook my mom's recipes, if for some reason, no matter if all the ingredients are there for greatness, just like when she cooks it, it's just not there. It winds up not tasting right. And that's sort of the feeling I got from this episode. It was a good episode in the sense that it feels like it adds to the continuity, it adds to the perceptions of Star Wars and that sort of thing, but it really kind of felt stale. There is so much in this episode that feels borrowed from something else. The Pandora rocks, the Tower at Baradur, or whatever you want to call it, even with the glowing light above it, that Anakin somehow runs to in record time, partially across the planet, it seems. You got all that type of stuff. You've got the basic plot line spoiled in the Clone Wars magazine, which doesn't hit newsstands until this week, this upcoming week, and yet hit subscribers a couple weeks ago. You have the clip of Qui-Gon again showing so much that it felt as though we pretty much saw everything that was meaningful from it. It just kind of felt like all the pieces were there, but for some reason, when it finally came together, we didn't get the kind of wow and amazing episode that I was expecting. I was expecting to be knocked on my butt, and instead I was tapped on the shoulder.
Well, you know, I think that has to do a lot with what Arnie said, that since this is an arc, they can't just give us everything at once. But I'm looking at what they did give us. And, you know, this isn't the only time we're going to see Qui-Gon, because it seems like they're going to be here for a while on this planet or whatever this environment is. So we might get more. We probably will get more Qui-Gon. We probably will get more adult Ahsoka.
I am going to actually kind of agree with everybody. I enjoyed the episode. I felt it was a nice setup for things to come and some interesting ideas were presented. But this episode did, to go along with Nathan, feel like a lot of things were borrowed. Right from the get-go, when we see the giant monolith in space, it felt very Star Trek the Motion Picture to me. It felt like going into the cloud of V'ger.
Or 2001, if you want to talk about space monoliths.
Yeah, it did resemble the monolith as well.
That's no moon. That's a Borg construct.
See, now we're just crazy. And then when we get on the planet, it's very much, it looks like Pandora. And then they get off the ship, and it's like they're walking through Final Fantasy 13. It's crazy. The towers, very much out of Two Towers. There was just so much borrowed from other things. It was hard to kind of focus. And then the whole arena test thing, it was very confusing. But all in all, nice setup. It was a beautiful episode. The visuals were stunning. The score was great. And I really enjoyed seeing the voice actors come back from episode one and from The Force Unleashed. So all in all, nice setup. Not my favorite, but still, I feel we're in a good place for season 3.5.
I agree with you there that a lot of this did feel like I was watching some weird YouTube fan-made mashup of, we're going to take Avatar's backgrounds and superimpose Clone Wars characters, and, oh, I like Final Fantasy, let's throw in a princess. The visual style, I have been, every episode I've been on, I think this season, I've praised the Clone Wars for its visuals. I still think they looked phenomenal here, but some pieces, especially the planet-dwelling female, did we ever get her name? The daughter?
She just called daughter. The daughter. Father, daughter, son.
Okay.
That's it.
The daughter just really looked right out of some anime cartoon. Like they borrowed the graphic and decided, we'll put her in Clone Wars. It's fine.
On the same token, you take Sun. Sun looks to me, I mean, Sun leaped out at me. And the first time I saw him, I thought, that is every generic Darksider or Sith Lord ever created by fans using the original West End Games RPG. Basically, I mean, he feels, and maybe that's the whole point. Maybe they're supposed to be iconic of Darkside or Lightside to such a degree that they're meant to look like they have features that they share with all kinds of beings who all share the dark side or light side affiliation. But he felt either universal in a positive spin or generic in the negative spin.
Sun reminded me a whole lot of Malak from the first Knights of the Old Republic game and later Knights of the Old Republic comics. Well, when he was Alec. Yeah, a very not so original character design for him. And I know we've seen characters like that show up in some of the promo stuff for the Old Republic to come. So maybe that is kind of what they're, just a generic Darksider use that they're going for. I don't know. Be interesting to see. All right, so let's go ahead and get right into the episode. We are told in the newsreel at the beginning that a message has come in from the far reaches of the Outer Rim. Buried deep inside is a distress signal that is a code that the Jedi have not used in over 2,000 years. Now, all the visuals that we see in this newsreel are brand new visuals to us. Very easily could have been a third of the episode in and of itself, including shots of the Jedi Council. We see a Republic cruiser with some new officers on it. I didn't get a chance to look too closely at the Jedi Council. Were there any surprises on the Jedi Council?
With the Jedi Council, we did not really wind up seeing anybody new. We saw Obi-Wan Kenobi confirming he definitely is on the Council at this point. We don't know yet about Stas Ali or Agen Kolar coming in to replace their predecessors. You know, who knows how that's going to wind up working out when they shuffle things around. But nobody new, but it was nice to see pretty much all of the character models we do have for the Jedi Council finally pulled into one place, with the exception of Sayisi Tim. And you also mentioned the signal used to contact the Jedi being not used in over 2,000 years. I gotta wonder if they're trying to purposely say that it was prior to the Sith Order that we know of, with Vader and Palpatine coming into existence. Because that was something George Lucas gave to Terry Brooks for the Phantom Menace novelization, to say it's 2,000 years prior, approximately, and then 1,000 years is when they start the Rule of Two and everything. The EU's expanded on it, but both of those are Lucasisms. I wonder if he's setting something else up here beyond what we already know, unless he's just trying to make them seem ancient somehow. It definitely seems like it predates Jedi and Sith in Lucas's vision, which is kind of cool.
Well, while the Clone Wars is very free, obviously, to plow down any EU it wants to, I think that with the huge Lucas Electronic Arts investment that is the Old Republic, that has to be one area right now where they have invested so much money and gotten not a penny of return yet, that I think that maybe that's an area they need to steer really clear from. And 2,000 years, kind of a dead zone.
Yeah, but at the same time, you've got the issue of if they're really trying to steer clear, the Old Republic is delving into the Jedi returning to Tython, their original homeworld, and supposedly is supposed to be delving into some of the secrets of the Force that they learned there and the origins of the Order, and yet this episode has Lucas, as we'll see, I'm sure, as we talk about the episode, Lucas essentially going back and, put it this way, if this is the balance of the Force that is meant to be the balance of the Force from the prophecy, Lucas isn't going back and changing EU. He's going back and changing what he has said, his interpretations of his own creation. And I gotta wonder how that may affect other things that are in the works right now, or if they're just told, you know, steer clear like they used to be in the Bantam days. Don't you dare do this because Lucas is allowed to do it, like when they told him don't go into the Clone Wars.
Well, we'll get to that prophecy later on.
Yes, we will.
Okay, so Anakin, Obi-Wan, and Ahsoka are dispatched in a shuttle to investigate, or to meet up with the Republic ship to investigate. And even though they're both at the same coordinates, they don't see each other. However, the Jedi shuttle loses power, and when it regains power, they are in front of a giant, for lack of a better term, monolith, floating in the middle of space that they are pulled into, and as the light gets brighter, they all black out. And when we wake up, we're inside, but on a planet.
All right, I just have to ask, did they wake up, really? Because doesn't this really feel like the It's All a Dream kind of episodes that they always rip you off with, certain series, every TV? Don't they always have the It's All a Dream episode?
Yes, they do.
Or if you're Dallas, the season?
or Lost. I mean, we have good and evil personified on this planet and all the spiritual elements of it. I mean, it's delving into goodness only knows how many different storytelling tropes here.
Well, am I the only one who is wondering if this is a dream, and if so, how much is a dream?
Oh, no, not at all. This is striking me also as the it's either a dream or, for some reason, from the first preview that we got this episode, this very much reminds me of Star Trek The Final Frontier, where they go to the center of the universe and they allegedly find God. And I have a feeling that at the end of this, we're going to find out these are just three crazy people who stumbled into Super Force Land and are messing with people who come too close, or they were reaching out for Anakin in the first place to mess with him. And it's not going to be one way or the other.
Dan? You're not the only one who thought Star Trek V during this. And I must say, if the Clone Wars people are reminding a good portion of their audience, half of this roundtable minimum, of Star Trek V, that's not a good thing. It really isn't. What I thought of it is when, later on in the episode, and I'm sure we'll talk about it then, but when Anakin is seeing his mother and the mother's like, let me take your pain. That's exactly what Cybok did to everybody to brainwash them, right? Let me take away your pain.
I'm not feeling this as a dream or anything like that, but it's certainly, I'm wondering about the veracity of father, son, and daughter, especially since we get more episodes in this trilogy that use father, son, and daughter. If they had just left, like it seemed like they were doing at the end, I'd be sitting there saying, huh, I wonder if they were telling the truth. Maybe they were. But with us coming back to it again, it seems like there's much more to discover. And I hope so, so that Lucas isn't turning around and kicking his own comments about balance of the Force in the butt.
The only evidence that I would say that this whole thing was a dream is two things. One is that the father, the daughter, and the son never use the Force. They're supposed to be the living embodiment of it, but they never use the Force. Anakin does when, you know, in his test, when Obi-Wan says this whole planet is the Force, and, you know, he uses the Force. But you never see the father use the Force. You never see the daughter or the son. You see them do some lightsaber controls, which was kind of interesting because they've always said that a lightsaber in itself has nothing to do with the Force. So when they were doing these tricks where they're grabbing the lightsaber and they're making the lightsabers deactivate, it's kind of supposed to convey that they have this mastery over the Force, but they're really not using the Force. And they're doing other trickery by shape-shifting and stuff like that, but without the use of the Force, I just think that is the only evidence that I could come up with what this is a dream, or Anakin's dream, because he's the one who's actually mastery of this world.
Yeah, unless they're all dreaming at the same time, it seems like it'd be very unlikely, because say this is Anakin's dream, why would Anakin dream of Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, who are far away from him at the time, having their own visions that we can then doubt where those came from? It seems like it's a little too complex and ethereal to say that it is a dream. Now, whether or not we should believe what we see and believe the visions, that's a whole nother story.
All right, and we'll get to the visions soon. The Jedi get off of their shuttle and they meet the daughter, who, as we've said, looks straight out of anime or a Final Fantasy or one of those Japanese surrealistic games. And for all the flack that Ahsoka's gotten for her outfits over the past couple of years, this chick that with the cut all the way down to her navel, that was a little bit surprising for a Cartoon Network show, but we've already gone past a lot of other things with this. I think we've established this is a mid to early teen show.
Are you an angel?
No, I'm a radioactive stripper.
Radioactive strippers.
Well, she's glowing.
They really aren't shying away from the sexuality in this series, are they? Because they've changed Ahsoka's attire, but it's still a little sexual. You know, after getting all of the feedback from the fans and how she's too sexual, and, you know, we see all the Twi'leks dancing on the pole, they're really not really shying away from the sexuality in Star Wars here.
I don't know that it's necessarily... I mean, nothing they've done has been sexual. Now, yeah, there is the boob window, but, I mean, it's only as sexual as you make it. I guarantee you that they have fashion designers who are working on these looks, and they just come up with this. But, you know, I personally think of sexual as more than just a look, you know? I think it's as sexual as you want.
Really? Because I thought Twi'leks dancing on stripper poles is pretty sexual. That's not, it's kind of, it's not like your interpretation of is this sexual or not. They're actually dancers dancing on the poles. Or the...
All right, there were. there were pole dancers, okay.
That's not much left to interpretation there. And they showed the adult Ahsoka. And the adult Ahsoka kind of has the same outfit as the preteen Ahsoka or the teenager Ahsoka. And I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, they didn't go with a more traditional robe, Jedi robe, as she got older. So I thought that's a point that they made as me saying that they're kind of embracing the sexuality of her, because they could have, you know, gave her robes or something. They could have done anything. Gave her armor like I've been crying for the last three seasons. But I just thought it was interesting that they're not shying away from it. You know, they're not shying away from it at all.
She has a uniform made of the unstable Fantastic Four molecules, so that as she grows up, it just grows with her and it just stretches out the boob window, which I'm sure is not there for sexualization. I'm sure it's just there to allow her chest to breathe. Right. But no, I will say, though, that the fact that she was in the original outfit or this current outfit, that she's in her younger outfit, did kind of strike me as somewhat unusual. I mean, she's grown up. She's got the longer head tails. Her forehead has become a five head, so to speak. And it's interesting because it made me wonder, you know, as we'll get into when we talk the visions, why wouldn't she, if that really is a vision of her future self, why wouldn't she be wearing something different? Why would she have to be wearing something so similar unless someone or something on that planet is able to see her as she is and no more, and develop essentially a future version of her based on her current looks to perhaps deceive her or lead her in the wrong direction? Otherwise, it really feels kind of like kind of clumsy character design. If you're going to make a whole new character model for Ahsoka for her older self, is she really going to be wearing the same thing she's wearing at 15, 16, however old she is, wearing that costume?
By the same token, if you are this multi-powerful being who can assume any persona, anything that you're reading from somebody else's mind, you have all that power, but you can't change the world. That doesn't make much sense.
Phenomenal cosmic powers, itty bitty closet.
Now, one thing about them first meeting the daughter, and it stuck out in my mind and will continue when we meet father and son, is we seem to be reusing the trick that they used in the previous arc with Mother Talzin and the Night Sisters, where everybody speaks with three voices. It was a little bit of overkill, I felt.
Unless Mother Talzin has more of a meaning, given that we have father, son, and daughter here, and the only other mother we've seen is Talzin. I doubt that that's going to happen. I thought, huh, when I heard the voices.
Now, see, I like that, and that's why they won't do it, but I like that. That would be a very interesting tie. I thought they just brought the folks in to record for this week's episode and forgot that they'd left the filter on for Mother Talzin, and, oh, let's just go with it. So they're following the daughter, and when she's questioned about where they're going to, she says, the father, of course. And then she says, we are the middle, the beginning, and the end. That struck me as a very almost biblical sounding line. It's very, very strange. Wonder what they're setting up with that.
it's I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. But they also later refer to a balance of creation, destruction, and that sort of thing. So you've got both sort of a Judeo-Christian angle here, but you can also take that as sort of a Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, Hindu type of cycle here that they're referring to, which they touch on later, which would be an Eastern style, I guess it's considered Eastern, an Eastern style, or at least Asian style religious influence, which I think fits more with the episode here.
All right, so right after the daughter explains this to them, there is a landslide or something. A large boulder falls and nearly crushes the daughter and separates Anakin and her from Ahsoka and Obi-Wan. Ahsoka and Obi-Wan head back towards the ship, whereas Anakin is with the daughter and she tells him, "You're in danger. Stay here alone at night on a cliff where things are falling." That sounds like a good call.
Which makes me wonder how omnipotent these beings actually are, or omniscient, whichever one of those is appropriate here, because then when Sun winds up confronting Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, he's like, "You didn't do what you were told. You were supposed to stay." And they're like, "We didn't, you know, hear that. There was a boulder and stuff in the way."
Exactly. They're supposed to know everything that's going on, but one hand doesn't seem to know what the other is doing. And maybe that's just how they are, being the daughter and the son, opposite sides of the Force. Maybe if the father, he would have known that they didn't get the entire message, but we will see. But as Nathan brought up, we have met now the son, who is voiced by Sam Witwer, who is Starkiller from The Force Unleashed, and previously we did meet the daughter, who is voiced by Adrian Wilkinson, who was Maris Brood. So the son advises Obi-Wan and Ahsoka that they should seek shelter because the storms on this planet are very dangerous. With that, he transforms and flies away, and they make a run for a nearby cave.
Kind of a helpful little weather tip there.
Yes, indeed. And apparently lightning striking makes glowing trees sprout. That was interesting. But the whole ecosystem on this planet is odd, or whatever it is.
Well, it's supposed to be, it's the way that it was described in the Clone Wars magazine is that it's a planet where as light and dark gain dominance, as the daughter and son's elements of the Force are essentially gaining dominance over the planet, and the moods and such are shifting, the planet is cycling through birth and death and night and day and all these things to sort of visualize that balance. Because you remember, as they came into the planet, they referred to it as essentially a biological mass, if I remember correctly. I forget the exact phrasing, but they didn't refer to it as essentially a normal planet, as if this whole thing is reshaping itself biologically, physiologically, in reaction to whatever's happening between those two opposing forces. No pun intended.
That's true. They did refer to that as a biological entity.
You know, what I thought interesting about the sun is that he's supposed to be the embodiment of the dark side, but he's kind of nice to him, wasn't he? He was, you know, I thought if you want to live, follow me if you want to live. I thought he was going to bust that out. He's kind of like the gentle giant. They kind of try to make him evil. And I hope as we go into the arc, he is more evil. He is more the embodiment of the dark side, because when he talks, it kind of yells, "You were supposed to wait here," you know, and kind of shows a little bit of the anger that he's inside that maybe he's trying to control. But I kind of thought that he might have been less helpful to them. You know what I mean? He is the dark side after all.
Unless his whole thing is to keep them there, because their ship was gone when they got back to it. If he was the one who removed the ship, perhaps, then he was steering them in the direction, perhaps, that he wanted them to go, into that cave, where, again, if those visions that they wind up seeing are somehow manufactured in order to manipulate them, that could have been him leading them directly into where he wanted them to be.
You could argue that, but then you could also argue that the visions that Ahsoka and Obi-Wan had were not the dark side, were not the son, but were the daughter.
Oh, yes.
But then they weren't talking to each other. So it's kind of confusing all the way around, you know, because is there a plan going on? Is there not a plan? Left hand, right hand type of thing.
Okay, so we've hinted at them. Let's take them down the order. They're in the cave. First of all, Obi-Wan has his vision of Qui-Gon. Now, of all three of the visions, this is the only one that I think may truly have been who it was intended to be. Well, I bear no illusions that the other two weren't. But this one, I think there wasn't any kind of trickery at work. I think this may have actually been Qui-Gon reaching out to try to steer Obi-Wan in the right direction in the midst of all this.
I hope so. I'm just going to say, if this was a deception, I would be very angry. I'm going to pull out an obscure reference. There was a character, it's not that obscure to our audience, I suppose. There was a character named Tara from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, played by Amber Benson. And they killed her. Spoiler alert, by the way. And then they wanted her to come back to portray an embodiment of a demon who would trick her girlfriend. And the actress would not return. She's like, I'm not going to come back and basically desecrate my character that I built by having my last appearance be deception and evil. And so they weren't able to do that, and the story was lesser for it. Here, if they got Liam Neeson back to portray a ruse, that, no, you don't, you know, it's Liam Neeson, and he's back as Qui-Gon, and just to really fool us all, that would really anger me.
See, I'm the opposite. I'm sitting here thinking, first off, it's nice that Liam Neeson is back, so that his last touch into Star Wars, his last appearance as Qui-Gon isn't, Anakin, no, that sounded like he was being strangled at the time he was recording it for episode 2, uncredited, if I remember correctly.
But did he actually record it for episode 2?
No, he did not. That was not specially recorded. He has said in interviews that his voice was in episode 2 and he didn't even have to record it.
I was going
to
say, you know, I could have pulled those lines out of episode 1 like that. I can do Audacity.
but it was his last appearance, whether it was recorded for episode 2 or not. It was still his last appearance in a Lucas-driven production outside, I guess, of somebody else voicing him in the 21st chapter, I think it was, of the Genndy Tartakovsky series ages ago, right before episode 3. But here he is back again, and that's awesome. It's great that they actually got Liam Neeson instead of somebody else to voice the character. I was shocked that he decided to come back. In fact, apparently Dave Filoni was kind of shocked too, as he says in his commentary, talking about Lynn Hale and being able to bring him in and Pernilla August and everything. But I kind of hope that this isn't really Qui-Gon. Maybe it is, or we can say that the only reason that Obi-Wan is able to communicate with Qui-Gon is because the planet Mortis is this crazy Force Nexus place. Because otherwise, when Yoda tells him he's going to commune with Qui-Gon, or his old master and such in Revenge of the Sith, and Obi-Wan looks at him and goes, Master Qui-Gon, that makes absolutely no sense that he wouldn't know that Qui-Gon was still around in the Force somewhere. It's Lucas adding to it in a way that if it's meant one way, it's fine, but it's a deception perhaps, or it's at least something that was unique. On the other hand, if it's meant the other way, the more obvious way, he's undermining his own stuff, which is exactly what he does with the Balance of the Force stuff, which I'm going to harp on till we get to it. It bothers me that he would bring him back in that form. But you notice we're not saying the same thing about Pernilla August. Pernilla August shows up as Shmi, and it's not, I can't believe that her last appearance would be a deception. And that's obviously a deception, and yet fans seem to be okay with that. Is it because it's her and not Liam Neeson?
Yep, that's exactly it.
Yes, that's exactly it.
See, that's just harsh.
But you know, Nathan, it could be, your hypothesis, it could be that that Qui-Gon is real, but Obi-Wan doesn't think he's real. So that could explain why he's so surprised at episode 3, because he hasn't convinced himself that this vision was real, even though it could be real. This vision was different in a few senses. One, the ghost aura that is around Qui-Gon is not around the other specters. So that right there could tell me that this projection is different than the other two, because you do have that Force ghost aura that's around him. Second, when he talks to Obi-Wan, it's very loving. You know, he has his back towards Obi-Wan and he's still trying to teach him. So that right there is telling me, you know, this could be Qui-Gon. This could be the real thing. And I think that maybe Obi-Wan hasn't convinced himself in episode 3 that this was the real thing.
Okay.
Here's one thing that we mentioned over on Star Wars Action News a couple weeks ago. Somebody hypothesized this on Facebook, and what do you guys think? It does seem odd, doesn't it, that Liam Neeson would return for this? Is it in anyone else's mind that maybe he also was recording something for the Blu-ray releases, maybe to clean up that clumsy scene at the end of episode 3 that Nathan was talking about?
See, that's a possibility. I also had in mind, and I hypothesized this on, I think it was last week's show, that with the introduction to Darth Maul still being alive last arc, and we're seeing Qui-Gon this arc, I think some things are being done to get people excited, and some things are going on for the big release of The Phantom Menace in 2012 in 3D. So I think there's some things in the work there. All these episode 1 actors are handy, so there's something going on in the background, whether it's with the, maybe it is with the Blu-ray release, maybe it is with episode 1 in 3D, maybe episode 1 in 3D is going to be its special edition. We'll see.
Version 3.0 of Phantom Menace, because they already tweaked it for the DVD release.
Exactly.
Well, I for one hope that he did record some extra stuff, because anything that he can record to clean up the ending that was episode 3, or even anything in episode 2, I mean, anything that's going to add to the story, I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, it's Liam Neeson. I mean, come on. I mean, I'm just glad that he decided that he was going to be, that he would come back and do this for us. And it's a treat. It's a treat, whatever they give us.
Maybe he'll have a scene set aboard the Tantive IV or the Sundered Heart as they're leaving right near the end of episode 3, where he turns to Obi-Wan and says, lost the will to live. You don't believe that crap, do you?
Always comes back to that.
Yes, I know, it Nathan. Does.
Let it go, man. You can't let it go. Huh?
And the second vision, Anakin gets to see his mommy. But it's not really her. It's the son. She asks Anakin to give her his pain. Once again, very hearkening back to Star Trek.
But how does this work for the son? This is what I'm not getting about this. And I'm sure it'll probably be explained later. But unless he's feeding off the pain or something somehow, if the whole idea is he's supposed to become the chosen one to bring balance and all that kind of stuff, why would the son, who supposedly is vying for control, why would he want Anakin to prepare himself for that? Why would he want, if he's a dark side character, to give Anakin a form of inner peace? It doesn't seem to make sense to me why he'd be doing that, unless somehow he feeds off of the pain in one form or another. He seemed to be doing something somewhat good there before he revealed himself as evil and took off as a gargoyle to go fight with his griffin sister.
See, Nathan, I took it as the son was trying to use the mother to bring out the dark side in Anakin. Like, he wasn't really trying to bring Anakin's pain away from him. Like, he knew that Anakin's the type of person where he's not going to let himself give up his pain, that he will use that anger to bring the dark side out. And I think that's what it was about, was they were showing Anakin that his mother's dead and can't be coming back, and that they're using his mother to try to gain some kind of influence with him, and then that would set him over the edge.
But it's
and
not I like, think, he's like, let it go. It'll be okay. Mommy's little boy will be fine. As opposed to, I can't believe you didn't save me. What did you do? I can't believe you. It seems like there would be so many different ways that they could use that, especially if this is aimed at least partially at children, where children would be able to get it. And I would be able to get it, I guess, if they wanted to have that be something that was pushing him darker. It feels as though they really were trying to give him some form of peace, which seems odd for the, you know, RPG Sith Lord looking son.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, to jump ahead to the end of the episode, they want him to stay. So if they could make this his happy place, maybe it would keep him to stay. Maybe these are some kind of force vampires that feed off his energy, and he's so powerful with the midichlorians and all.
But father wants him to stay. Son and daughter are supposedly vying for control. The only way they can be kept in check is father. Father's like the intergalactic metaphysical babysitter for these two. Son isn't wanting him to stay. Son would want him to be gone, so when father dies, there is no balance, and he can vie for control. It, again, within the context of the episode, I don't see where it fits. I'm hoping we get more of an explanation in the next two. He's feeding off the pain or something, but I don't think in the context of the episode that scene made sense. It would have made much more sense had it been the daughter manipulating him, the light side, so to speak, not the son. Unless we're going to find that those are reverse, and it's actually the son that represents light and the daughter represents dark somehow.
Well, why do you assume that if the father is gone, that the dark side automatically gains control?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they would be out of balance and could vie for control. The father is what is keeping them balanced, so to speak, and it would give him a chance to at least try to tip the scales, whereas right now, he can't.
It does really come across like that to me, too, that this is like light side, dark side, and balance. Or to take it into the psychological level, since Nathan said we need a psychologist, you've got the id, the ego, and the father is the superego, thus deciding between the two. And much like the angel and devil on the shoulder, if you knock one off, the other side gains control.
Well, they're really pushing the Eastern philosophy stuff here too. I mean, you've got the symbol that resembles a Taoist yin and yang style symbol, and they even, assuming it really is light side daughter, dark side son, they are pushing that Taoist sort of perspective on it, because usually yin is presented as the softer, gentler, kinder side, and female, light side female, whereas the harsher side, the more angry side, the fiery side is the male side, dark side son. They're really barreling down this Taoist road in a lot of respects, and it again, it would seem as though you could throw balance off, which we'll talk about when we get into this what the balance of the force is supposed to mean according to Lucas. I just keep hinting at that. I guess I'm chomping at the bit here.
The most interesting thing about that whole Anakin seeing his mother bit was that I'm the chosen one. I can't get a pillow. I can't be comfortable.
That was the most.
If I am the chosen one, why am I on a yak in Tibet and you sitting in a warm movie theater?
I mean, they're more comfortable on a prison barge. This guy's the chosen one, you know? Can't get a posturpedic.
Yes, anyway. I caught the Golden Child reference. Then we flash over to Ahsoka having her vision.
It did seem as though they are slowly but surely providing an out for Ahsoka. I mean, we've been saying for ages, you know, what's going to happen to her? Is she going to go off on her own? Is she just going to disappear? Certainly, they're probably not going to kill her in a supposedly kids series and so forth, maybe in something else. But the idea of, you know, you'll never see your future if you remain his apprentice, or however they worded it, certainly seems as though they're opening up the possibility of her walking away. Very much like they sort of opened her eyes to the other side back in Heroes on Both Sides.
Absolutely. I felt that this was giving her hints of get the crap away before it's too late. And also, is there any doubt that this was the daughter approaching Ahsoka?
I don't think it was any doubt that the daughter was in the cave with Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, and I think the son was with Anakin. That's how I got it. But can I just say that adult Ahsoka rocked? Wasn't adult Ahsoka cool? I mean, she had the long leku. She looked really regal and almost like, I mean, she really looked like a Jedi, like a Jedi master. I mean, I got that as, you know, she survived. She looks really good. I mean, they put little bags under her eyes for a little shadow there. And I thought she rocked. I thought adult Ahsoka rocked. And it actually got me excited to know Ahsoka's story, because up until this point, I've always thought Ahsoka would die as a child. But, you know, this is kind of saying in there that she could actually leave the position as Anakin's Padawan and actually go on and do something herself, and that she may be able to survive. And I thought that was great. I think that was really cool. So I thought that was a really powerful scene.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, it really was probably the most powerful scene in the entire thing, except maybe Anakin versus the two creatures, so to speak, at the end. It's nice to have something to at least look forward to and say, this is what Ahsoka could be. It reminds me of, I mean, among other things, you look back at Babylon 5, and they had an episode in the first season called Babylon Squared, whose whole point was to set up future events. It's we're seeing the future, and then I don't think it was until season 3 where you finally got a chance to go through those events and know what it all meant, what you were seeing, but it gave you a chance to look ahead and see where the characters could possibly be, and it gives you a sense that you're leading up to something. There's the old saying, I think it was Straczynski from Babylon 5 who had said it, that the important part, the more interesting part, is the journey. It's not the ending point. Knowing where you're going is actually sometimes better to get you interested in how you get there. And certainly Ahsoka has a little more depth to her thanks to this episode. That was one of the best parts of the episode.
See, I've never thought she was going to die, and I think it's a foregone conclusion that, you know, whenever the series wraps up, by the time of episode 3, Ahsoka is not Anakin's Padawan. But given that this is quite obviously a deception, it doesn't really allow for any new possibilities, does it?
Assuming that it is a deception, which we think it probably is, but you don't ever see any real, I mean, you see emotional shifts in her there at the end where she gets kind of angry or she gets kind of forceful with younger Ahsoka. But whereas with the son, we see him transform and leave. In the case of Qui-Gon and older Ahsoka, we can say we think that it's daughter or we think that it's whomever, but we don't see them do anything as it wraps up as far as transforming or the way they disappear that in any way tells us, yes, this is definitely a deception. So it's possible this is opening up an actual door. Or at least, if nothing else, it gives us a way of saying this is what Ahsoka at least would like to see herself being, or this is a form of her idealized looking toward the future. Either way, it gives us something to visualize for Ahsoka other than her as she is right now. Although, how she would fight as a Jedi with those incredibly, incredibly long head tails, I don't know, unless she's using them to batter opponents as she spins or something.
That was the one thing that made me think, not the Leku part, but the one thing that made me think maybe this wasn't daughter was because older Ahsoka was slightly transparent, just like Qui-Gon was. Whereas Anakin's vision of Shmi, she was tangible. She was there. She was touching him. They were interacting. So that struck me as kind of different. So maybe that wasn't the daughter, but maybe we'll find out in the next episode or two.
But then we get to the test of what it's all about.
Anakin decides to confront the father on these visitations, well, on his visitation. And as usual, Anakin's a little bit pissy, not exactly the nicest or the most diplomatic guy when it comes to sitting down and having a chat. And the father says, well, let's find out together if you are the chosen one, and summons his children to kidnap Ahsoka and Obi-Wan.
I don't know. I heard the father say, you know, let's do this. And then immediately before seeing this episode, I finally had a chance to see the last Saw. So I couldn't help but think of the father going like, hello, Anakin. I'd like to play a game. You know, it's just it's like, really, what exactly are you going to put him through now?
Well, that was a little bit weird when Anakin says, I'm not going to play your game. The father says, well, no, I think you will, actually. So really, that makes it kind of seem not so all supreme being fate of the universe. It seems more like crazy guy on a power trip being a little too pushy with his power to me.
I thought that the you will was I've got your friends. So, yeah, you're going to, you know, resist all you want. But when we actually get out there and you see that one of them could die, you're going to do it anyway.
And now when we said the father represented balance at this point, I mean, isn't this the classical villain thing? I mean, didn't we see the Green Goblin do this in Spider-Man or the Riddler do this in Batman Forever where I've got your two friends. You can save one. Which one? You know, it's like, okay, so now we're saying the father's a bad guy.
Except he's doing it for Anakin's good. So he is kind of like Jigsaw in the Saw film. He's like, you know, it will teach you who you really are. You know, that sort of thing. I'm putting them in danger, but I'm giving you a chance to save them. And you need to live up to your potential. Therefore, he's giving him an opportunity, not threatening to kill them.
You know, at the same time, though, by doing the classic villain move, just as Arnie mentioned, it weakens him. It weakens him. He couldn't sell it. He could not sell it. If he was so powerful and he's the father and this is the chosen one, sell it. And he couldn't do it. He had to do, he had to go the cheap route and put Anakin's loved ones in danger that Grievous could do, you know, not this all powerful father. And in a lot of ways, it weakened him for me.
True, but isn't he also, I mean, he's trying to bring out what Anakin is most capable of. And with Anakin, his big thing has always been attachments to other people. So if you want to bring out the pinnacle of his power, if you wanted to get him to recognize what he truly is capable of in terms of his force use, you have to push the button that is more likely to get that type of response to it. So putting them in danger, while granted is the classic villain type of move here, it also is the thing you would think that could cause Anakin to reach out and try to go beyond the limitations that he already has. You know, I'm not sure how much it weakens him and makes him look like a villain so much as it's, he's like the Morpheus. You know, he's just kind of sitting back and he's giving you the test, and what happens is kind of up to you. Or maybe even taking another example from Babylon 5, he's the Kosh character. He's basically saying, look, your destiny is in your hands, but if you fail in the tests that are set before you, you or others will be destroyed. You must live up to your potential. It's like a test you dare not fail.
Again, the salesman part that he did not have. You know, I liked what we had, but I would have liked it better if he would have showed Anakin how important he was, instead of just kind of saying, you're important, it's chosen one. That's why Anakin decides to leave, you know, because it's not important to him. You know, it's what should have been his destiny, his, you know, I'm showing you the scroll of what the chosen one is, that was taken away with, now Ahsoka's going to die, you better choose. And, you know, maybe, you know, in the next couple episodes, that will be more explored of how powerful and how important it is for him to make this decision and stay. But I just didn't get it from the quote-unquote final test. The quote-unquote final test was just exerting his power over three evil people. And, I mean, maybe the daughter's not evil, but it just didn't seem that why was this the final test? You know, I don't know. I was confused.
But, you know, if he really was trying to force things, though, why make the threat during the test, but not make the threat when they're trying to leave? Here he is saying, this is your destiny. You must stay. He's not saying you must stay or else. He's making it a free choice. That's why I'm wondering if we're reading a little too much of malicious intent into the test itself. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you can interpret a lot of different ways, but I'm not seeing the villainy here. I guess I'm seeing him being willing to put others at risk for something he thinks of as so amazingly galactically important that maybe Anakin doesn't think is nearly as important. You know what I mean? He's willing to cross that line for a greater good, as opposed to the, you know, that he's twirling his mustache and saying, hey, you're gonna have to save one of your friends.
That's all he was missing, though. Oh, I think you will. The train is coming.
See, but Nathan, that's actually how I kind of took it, too, is these are two beings, and they matter nothing in the great scheme of things in the universe as far as the balance of the Force goes, but he's going to use them to show Anakin. I think this test went exactly the way he planned on it. He is, in that respect, just like Mother Talzin. He always has a plan within a plan within a plan, maybe. Not that many plans. But this went exactly like he planned it to, and this showed Anakin what he wanted him to see. And by putting those two in danger in that way, he got exactly what he wanted out of Anakin.
Right up until he flat out left.
Well, yes, there was that. But then there's the whole wife thing, but he can't talk about that in front of Obi-Wan.
Well, I gotta say, Anakin taking down those pterodactyl things, though, was really cool. What do you guys think of the music during that scene? I thought it really heightened it, but yet it seemed out of place. It didn't seem like Star Wars-y music.
The whole episode didn't really feel Star Wars, to be honest with you, at least from my perspective.
Now, I felt the score in the episode was really good as far as Star Wars. We saw a lot of callbacks to the Imperial March. There was a reference to, I believe the song was actually called The Force, or The Force Theme, or Yoda's theme, or whatever it is. And as far as that scene, if I remember right, it was very, a lot of vocal parts in it. And that's something that we've seen in a lot of the prequel trilogy music. So that wasn't too far of a stretch, I didn't think.
So why did the father want Anakin to... What is the thing there? I'm back to kind of like that Force vampire thing.
Well, because he's going to die, and because of Anakin's power, he would be able to keep the two children in check. Because there are forces out there that would like both sides to gain the upper hand. And that's an interesting concept that I would like to see them touch on later in the next two episodes, too, is who among the Jedi knows or theorizes that these folks are out here would like the daughter to get the upper hand?
Yeah, it's like the idea is supposed to be this is this nexus, so to speak, of the Force, supposedly, and you've got light and dark as personified here. Both of them are extremely powerful. They're able to draw upon the power of that place. If one or the other became extremely powerful, it would throw everything out of balance. So you need essentially someone who is the parent figure to keep them in check, to keep them grounded. And he has to be so powerful that only father or the so-called chosen one, presumably Anakin here, is going to be able to keep them controlled. It's that idea of sort of a Taoist form of yin yang, light dark type of balance, which doesn't even remotely match what Lucas has said before. Is this a good time to go into the whole prophecy and balance of the Force stuff? The whole balance of the Force thing, the whole prophecy of the Chosen One, has gone through all these different permutations, and the EU has touched on it from time to time, but really most of the interpretation we've got of this comes from Lucas or comes from the films. There's effectively two prophecies. You've got the Jedi prophecy and the Sith prophecy. The Sith prophecy, people tend to think, comes from Lucas also. It's not. It's that idea that there's this Sith Ahri, this ultimate Sith that's supposed to be developed, and that somewhere along the way, I guess this is where they think it's a Lucas thing, Anakin is created by Sidious through teachings from Plagueis. He's created, and that's something that has been confirmed later within the EU, and I can't imagine they would have confirmed that without Lucas's okay, but that somehow they're trying to create him to be this Sith Ahri, this ultimate chosen one Sith. But now that it seems like that's not the direction anything is going, they've turned around and retconned that back to say, oh, actually, that was Darth Bane. And 1,000 years later, Palpatine apparently somehow must not have known about it or something, or was trying to recreate it. So whatever. So there's the Sith prophecy that some people attribute to Lucas. which seems to be based on some of Lucas's ideas, but is not a Lucas creation. Then you got the actual Chosen One Jedi prophecy, and that one is Lucas-based. We don't know whether or not the prophecy specifically says that you've got to have a child born of the midichlorians. We only know it's got to be someone very, very powerful, so maybe that was part of the prophecy. Maybe Lucas is just out there saying, see, here's this parthenogenesis, this virgin birth, and that's our way of saying he's just going to be super powerful. It's a way of saying he's a chosen one, like in different religious tales from a bunch of different cultures. But after that, we get a lot of vagueness about it. You refer to the prophecy of the one who will bring balance to the Force. Okay, what the heck does that mean? And a lot of people have taken that to mean, well, at the end of episode 3, Anakin brings balance. Because you get 2 and 2. There are 2 Sith left. There are 2 Jedi left. See? That's balance. Only, that doesn't fit what Lucas has said. What it turns out is, if you go back to what Lucas has actually said, there is this interview supposedly out there where he basically says that the natural state of the universe is good. The light side is normal. Leave it alone. The light side is there. It's like a Locke type of philosophy, basically. You've got this idea that everything is generally good and evil comes in, the dark side comes in and it corrupts it. It's like a cancer. It's like something that drives it down. It's an unnatural part of this system, that it's not a matter of yin and yang, that it's a matter of goodness is natural, what is evil is not. Now, this goes along with some of the other stuff that he has said later. Wikipedia out there right now has all kinds of information about those ideas on its Chosen One page. Unfortunately, they are attributing it to the mythology of Star Wars documentary that was done by Bill Moyers with George Lucas that aired on PBS. I've got that on DVD. Watched it 3 times yesterday in preparation for this episode. Nothing even remotely like that is in the episode in the documentary that they claim that it's coming from. So those ideas possibly suspect, but it does fit with what he said elsewhere from the episode 2 behind the scenes feature that was on the A New Hope tape in the 2nd special edition VHS release. He refers thus.
Which brings us up to films 4, 5, and 6, where Anakin's offspring redeem him and allow him to fulfill the prophecy, where he brings balance to the Force by doing away with the Sith and getting rid of evil in the universe.
See, he's basically saying there exactly what this supposed interview had said, that by destroying evil, not by bringing a balance between good and evil, Anakin restores balance to the Force. Hence why the Jedi would want it, and why Obi-Wan would say in episode 3, it was said you would destroy the Sith. Okay, but what does that have to do with this episode, even remotely? It's Lucas saying the idea of balance is supposed to be that good triumphs because good is natural, evil is not. Or vanquishing evil brings balance. Well, okay, then where do we get this idea of good and evil must be balanced and that there is someone who has to be there to keep each side in check? It makes me wonder if this is something that is a complete red herring, which goes back to the whole Final Frontier type of idea here, or if Lucas has just changed his mind again on what this thing is supposed to mean from the films. As he says in a real quote from that Mythology of Star Wars PBS special.
It's not like I'm working from a finished thing. I'm working from something where you have a lot of pieces and it's vague and you try to put it together.
Where do these rough ideas come from?
Now that I don't know. That's a mystery.
So he really is kind of changing his ideas as he goes along. He doesn't have a lot of stuff set in stone, as we've seen with the special editions and such being changed over and over. So thus far, this episode's version of Balance of the Force bears zero relation to what he has said it has meant in the past. He refers to balance within oneself plenty of times. Balance of the Force.
The thing is, before the prequels, he also said different things happened in the prequels. And he also said different things happen with Boba Fett. You know, initially Boba Fett was going to be a super commando and then he became a clone. So, you know, what Lucas says at any given moment and then what Lucas later puts on page, Lucas interviews, despite, you know, what you do for the timeline, Lucas interviews aren't in universe canon. They can be taken as clarifications.
But then you have why would Obi-Wan be referring to the prophecy referring to him destroying the Sith specifically? Lucas has gone around claiming this in multiple interviews as he's gone along, and it just seems as though he is, if anything, it's being reinterpreted here. Now, we talked in the last episode, we had that great voicemail that came in about how Lucas has every right to come in and reinterpret things over top of the EU because he's the guy who created this stuff. But if this is a new interpretation of Balance of the Force coming from Lucas, this isn't him overriding EU stuff. This is him overriding himself. And that kind of makes me worried, because it's different when it's something like, well, there are going to be one episode, then 12 starting with A New Hope, then 9 with A New Hope being 4, now there's 6, and I always intended there to be 6. Or Luke and Leia not originally being meant to be siblings, and then he decides they are siblings in the process of making the classic trilogy. Because that's stuff that really didn't bear anything onto the films until the final decision was made. We already have a few mentions of the prophecy in the prequel trilogy, and we have this assertion by Obi-Wan that the prophecy says he's supposed to destroy the Sith. And that was what bringing balance was apparently supposed to mean. A prophecy misread could have been, but a prophecy incredibly different seems bizarre to me. That's why I'm thinking this is probably it's probably a red herring. We're probably not really getting what they say we're getting. The secrets revealed feels to me like we're getting secrets that will have to be reinterpreted once all is said and done in this trilogy.
And if I'm not mistaken, that pretty much covers everything continuity-wise this week, correct, Nathan?
Yep, pretty much. The only continuity stuff was Lucas's own, really, this time.
All right, so we've got 5 voicemails this week.
Wow.
Except we have more than that, it's just we're not showing them all or playing them all.
Hi, my name is Devin Cox. I just wanted to call and leave a quick observation on the latest episode of The Clone Wars. I don't know, maybe it's just that I haven't slept in 48 hours, but looking at the vision scene of Ahsoka when she looks into the fire the last time, it seems oddly distorted. And I went back and I checked the DVD, and it sure as heck looks to me like that is Darth Vader's funeral pyre from Return of the Jedi. I don't know, just a thought. Thanks, bye.
I'm going to go with that. That's just him, but go ahead, Nathan.
You know, I looked at it and sort of zoomed it in and everything, and it looks like it is a little bit wider than what we're seeing whenever we then see the adult Ahsoka again. But I think it was just the way that it was reflected as opposed to it actually being the funeral pyre. But it is kind of an interesting thing to consider. And far be it for me to argue with, if this is the same, Devin Cox, the one guy who's ever let me play a Sith Lord in his audio drama. Not to the Old Republic Outcasts. It's StarWarsFanWars.com.
I went back also, watched it again. I'm not seeing it, but I do know that they do try to put those little visual hints and callbacks in wherever they could, so it could be there.
Now, Devin, get some sleep.
Hey there, Republic Forces fans. This is Dale, Jedi partner from the forums. I just got done watching the latest episode of The Clone Wars, and holy cow, I am just blown away by the fact that they have just sort of expanded on the mythology of the Chosen One and what it may or may not mean. I just can't say enough about how this season has progressed. I mean, it started slowly, but I did enjoy a lot of those boring Senate episodes and those boring Padme episodes, but it's just really kicked into high gear. Thanks so much for having a great podcast each week, and may the Force be with you all. Take care.
Thank you, Dale. Always nice to hear that folks are enjoying the podcast.
Perhaps it's because I'm from Illinois, but I could only think of Harry Carey. Holy cow!
You see, and when you say Harry Carey, I can only think of the old,
it is a long fly ball. Where's my beer?
That's the same Harry Carey, but his big thing was holy cow.
Yeah, exactly. Minus the where's the beer aspect, which is what I was getting at. But thank you for killing the joke.
Hey, everybody. Cozy here from Marvelicious Toys. Just calling in with some thoughts on the latest episode of Clone Wars. So, first let me say I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener there. So, all right, keep up the great work. I really dug this latest episode. I'm somebody who keeps watching these episodes, but never really gets, you know, too heated up one way or the other about it, and I'm not too worried about continuity or if it's screwing up the EU, so I'm sure there'll be some issues with some folks on those points. But for me, I really like this portrayal of a race or a few people that are the Force, essentially. You know, they're kind of the culmination of the light side and the dark side. They're neither Sith nor Jedi. And I thought that was kind of cool. It was almost like an apology for the whole midichlorian thing. You know, this is, to me, this is a way cooler path and a way cooler explanation. And I think think the choice that they left Anakin with there at the end is just as telling as anything else that we've seen in any of the movies to explain how his destiny is shaped from there on out. You know, he walked away and was basically cursed by that Force guy. I'm horrible with the people's names here, but that, you know, to me, that says a whole lot more about who Anakin Skywalker is and who he's to become and the choices he had to make and the stakes that were involved with it. So beyond that, I thought it looked gorgeous, you know, aside from the few Pandora unobtainium floating rocks and stuff like that. But I suppose it makes sense that the whole place is, you know, the living force. I guess that makes some sense. But the other part that I really thought was visually stunning and kind of poetic was when Anakin was in his trial there and he had to win his test between the light side and the dark side, when he was using the dark side to save both Ahsoka and Obi-Wan, the sky got dark and stormy, kind of representing the, obviously, him using the dark side of the Force. So, all right, well, that's my thoughts on it. Talk to you guys later. Have a great show. Bye.
Thank you, Cozy. I didn't necessarily take that entirely to be Anakin using dark side of the Force when he made the brother and or son and daughter submit to his will. I took that more of him just, as Obi-Wan said, using the Force that was the planet, not necessarily dark side.
I didn't see it as dark side either, but he was pissed. So maybe he was unleashing a little bit of anger there.
And he's making them kneel. He's forcing them, you know, kneel before me, you know, kneel before Zod. You know, it's sort of it's definitely the type of trope that we usually see with more of a villain character than with a heroic character. And I gotta say, I sort of agree with the idea that, assuming that this really is part of the nature of the Force, they're not just pulling a BS on the secrets revealed, that it really is that we're getting more about the origins of the Force and real balance, even if it does contradict what Lucas said before. I like the idea of giving it more of the metaphysical twist, more of like the beings as avatars of Force beings, of Force energy on Earth. It's like the idea of sort of a Brahman Nirguna type thing and the energy coming from it in Hinduism. I like that idea much better than the idea of being something biological that you can't seem to control. Because, I mean, it doesn't seem like you can take midichlorians. Logically, it would seem like you would have to take midichlorians and give them to somebody to create your own Force being. Although I do think there was one Infinity story where they tried to say that Dooku was siphoning blood from the stasis or whatever body of Sypha Dyas to put into, I think it was Grievous, actually. But you would think that in a universe where they've given this biological answer to the Force, you would see more manipulation of it to turn people who aren't Force users into Force users. There's still that metaphysical, why can't you do it? And this at least adds to that metaphysical view of the Force rather than what we got with the midichlorians. I don't think they're ever going to get rid of the midichlorians, but at least it gives us more the metaphysical side of it, which matches more what Lucas says when he talks about religion and such, and spirituality and what he wanted to do with the Force when you look at things like mythology of Star Wars, or the short clip from that that's on the Joseph Campbell Power of Myth documentary.
Okay, our next voicemail comes from Austin, not Texas.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, I thought you were like Larry King. Go ahead, Austin!
Hi, this is Austin, calling in with my review of this week's latest Star Wars episode, Awesome, or as it's officially called, Overlords. First off, this episode was amazing because this is the first time we actually get to see Ahsoka use her new double lightsabers and her new character look, besides her standing and talking in back a couple of the episodes. Okay, first off, the monolith that they fly into. I have no idea what that is. I've never heard anything like that. So maybe there's something there. Okay, when they first get to the planet and they have the light side sister and the dark side brother, that kind of mixed it up a little bit. I thought there would be two brothers vying for power, like in some of the other stories. And I wonder if you noticed that when they went to go grab Ahsoka and Obi-Wan later on in the episode, the light side sister grabbed Obi-Wan and the dark side brother grabbed Ahsoka. So I'm wondering if there's a connection with that and the preview we see in the next one, and how Obi-Wan told Anakin to save Ahsoka, who is with the dark side brother, to go to there. I don't know if that's anything with Anakin going to the dark side, but Oh, and when they get there, when you have that overlook of the back of the monastery, I wonder if you noticed that the ground was shaped sort of like the yin-yang symbol that means balance as well. I thought it was a nice callback to the latest Avatar movie with the blue people and the glowing trees during the storm. And I really enjoyed seeing Qui-Gon again. And I'm really happy that they got the guy who acted him to come back and do the voice. That was an excellent touch. Although the older version of Ahsoka kind of made me think Shaak Ti a little more with those long Leku, or however you want to call them. I don't know how she would fight with those. I couldn't imagine her doing that. But at the same time, I was a little confused because we saw Anakin, his mom, being impersonated by the Darkseid brother. So is the Darkseid brother also impersonating the older Ahsoka, who's at the Lightseid sister? There's something weird going on there, I'm sure of it. And looking forward to next week's episode, wondering how the dark Ahsoka will fit into this. I read on the StarWars.com about the Darkseid brother wanting to take power, feeling that there needs to be more Darkseid. So I don't know if he's just impersonating Ahsoka again or possessing her, changing her thoughts, something like that. I'm not certain. Really looking forward to the show and next week's episode. See ya.
Thanks, Austin. You know, we didn't talk much about the Ahsoka voice. You know, when he mentioned the Qui-Gon's voice by Liam Neeson, and then immediately started talking about Ahsoka's adult vision. What did you guys think about the voice there? Because it was quite obviously a different voice, quite obviously also still Ashley Eckstein, but either just enhanced digitally or pitching her voice a little differently.
I thought that it was really well done. I mean, at first, didn't necessarily sound like her, and obviously the way she looked around, she didn't know who it was either, and of course not, it's cartoon, she's not real. But the way that it was, that she first started speaking to her, and then the more she talked, you could recognize that it was Ashley Eckstein, it was Ahsoka's voice. I thought that was really well done, and showed that maybe Ashley does have some depth to her vocal work. That's not a mean.
I don't think it comes off as mean. Ashley and Matt Lanter and primarily the face actors from the show just use their voice. They were hired to do their voice. And then you've got the voice actors like Tom Kane and James Arnold Taylor, who are these astounding mimics and can do all these different voices of people, both real and imagined. So, you know, it's interesting to see one of the face actors kind of branching out with their vocals a little bit more, and you wonder if maybe some of their voice actor brethren are rubbing off on them.
You know, other than interviews that she's done, I've never heard Ashley Eckstein speaking, you know, interviews, behind the scenes stuff and that sort of thing. I've never spoken to her in person or through direct interviews as you guys have. But I will say that it's unusual, and it sort of seems like she plays a little bit younger, a little more naive or whatever as she's playing Ahsoka. But usually when we see voice actors having to do flashes into the future or visions of the future, we almost always see a character that's already an adult flashing forward to being an older adult. Here we have someone who, it was kind of interesting because she was able, assuming she is taking her voice and making her tone of voice a little younger when she performs as Ahsoka, it seemed like she was using more of a natural voice, a more adult, as she is an adult voice, for the adult Ahsoka. Instead of it being someone having to project themselves to be older than they really are, because they're naturally the age of the character, here was someone who was sort of required to euthanize, okay, euthanize is not the right word, youthify,
that's the answer.
Yeah, there you go. to de-age their voice normally, who could now go to a more normal speaking tone for this flash forward. I thought that was an interesting touch. I'm glad they didn't try to grab somebody else and have them trying to mimic Ashley to be Ahsoka. It was a nicely done scene. As for what he also mentioned, I didn't even think about two things really that he brought up there that now I'm kind of thinking on having first heard the voicemail. One being, is there symbolism as to who goes to whom? You know, we have the dark side son going to Anakin as Shmi, but if it's the light side daughter who, instead of it being actual visions, who is going to Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, what does that mean? Maybe the father went to one of them. What would that have meant? And is the dark Ahsoka that we saw in preview clips and that we saw in the preview of next week, is that even Ahsoka? Is it possible that is a vision being played for Anakin rather than being Ahsoka herself? Maybe it's the sun. I doubt it, but it certainly opens up other possibilities of how to perceive what's coming. So kudos to Austin, who's not in Austin.
Hi, this is Laurent calling in from Oklahoma, and I just want to talk about last night's episode of The Clone Wars. Overall, I give the episode a 9 out of 10. And the only reason I don't give it a 10 out of 10 is because it was such a great episode to just sort of kind of end so quickly. I don't know if it was just me or... But it kind of... It stands... I feel like it's going to stand so great as a trilogy that separating it into 3 weeks is almost like torture, you know? But anyway, it had an interesting plot. And had so far some of the best voice acting that I've heard in the show. And actually, now that I just got done watching it again, I noticed that Anakin's voice acting in this episode was a little above average this time. A little different this time around. I felt like he was really in character, you know, just even from the very beginning when he was talking to Rex. Felt like it was a nice step up, you know, not even just Anakin, but even Ahsoka and Obi-Wan, too. I know it's because I've been looking into voice acting lately, and I thought one of the best ways to do that is to watch and learn and listen from those that are experienced in the field and that. It's pretty much why I watch cartoons sometimes, but I never thought I would be this impressed with the Clone Wars voice acting, but, I mean, not in a bad way, but, I mean, when the Clone Wars first started, with the Clone Wars movie, the voice acting in that was okay, but as the series went on, it felt like it just got, you know, better and better until now it's just like, wow, these guys are getting really good at what they do, you know? Anyway, I have a question, a few questions actually, about the visions that they had in this episode. Particularly Anakin's right now, but, okay, I understand that in Anakin's vision or dream or whatever you want to call it, that wasn't actually his mom, but it was the guy known as Son. So, could that be the same situation with Ahsoka and Obi-Wan? I mean, was that really future Ahsoka, considering that wasn't really Anakin's mom? So could we possibly say that Ahsoka's vision was fake? And maybe the daughter or someone else was trying to get into Ahsoka's head or convince her that her master is evil for possibly her own safety? And I didn't quite understand the meaning of Obi-Wan's vision, unless I missed something, which I'm sure I did. So if you guys could clarify those three visions for me, unless you haven't already before this voicemail was played, but that would be great. Okay. Thanks, guys. Bye.
We'd like to thank you for sending in a voicemail recorded in that same cave in which the visions took place.
You know, I think we kind of hypothesized as much as we can about the visions. I will say, though, that specifically, I thought Matt Lanter turned in a vocal performance in this episode stronger than he's ever been. The others, I don't know. I think, again, that the voice actors have always brought their A game, but I think they're more comfortable in the role. But I do think Matt Lanter and Ashley Eckstein are really taking it to the next level this season.
You know, Arnie, I totally agree with you. And specifically, one line sticks out for me for Matt Lanter in this episode, where he's really, really embracing Anakin. He's kind of he's not, like you had said on an earlier podcast, he's not really trying to mimic Hayden Christensen. You know, he's trying to do his own thing. And one line specifically is when they get separated from each other on that rock, and he's talking to Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, and the daughter is walking away. He says to Obi-Wan, he's all, "She's walking away," you know, and it's like, at that moment there, I said, well, you know, this guy's really turning a corner here.
Yeah, definitely beats his performance in Sorority Row.
Thanks for the voicemails, everybody. And just want to remind everyone that If you want to leave us a voicemail and be a part of the next Republic Forces Radio Network, you can get a hold of us. Where at, Arnie?
415-508-JEDI.
Somebody's finally sung instead of me.
Excellent.
And I was just off key enough to not get sued by Empire Carpet.
Yeah, dude, it's like dun 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 diggy dun dun.
Oh, are we really going to go down that road again this week, too?
Wow.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Seeing this preview of next week, it feels like we've been sort of beating up on this episode. I don't think it's so much that we're meaning to beat up on the episode. I think there's a lot of good in it, but for lack of a better term, there were elements that were almost baffling, where their answers aren't there. And since there aren't answers there, we can only speculate. So it seems like this episode of Republic Forces has been a lot of speculation and almost nitpicking because we don't have answers, concrete answers to discuss in a lot of ways. It was a good episode, but it wasn't what it could have been. It probably, in this context of the trilogy, will wind up feeling better. Because of that, though, I look at next week's preview, and while I want to get excited about it, and I am excited about the whole dark side looking Ahsoka thing, it's hard for me to get really excited because this episode didn't leave me pumped for the next episode. And here, when we were going to see the possibility of a dark side Ahsoka, I was thinking regular universe. And now it looks like she's going to be doing her whole dark side dance on Mortis, where we're even questioning what's real in many respects with it and how much of it is truly what they're experiencing versus something that is just something that only could possibly happen on Mortis. I'm almost disappointed. In fact, I am disappointed. Not even almost. I am disappointed that we won't be seeing, it seems, dark side Ahsoka outside of this strange place that has such strange effects on people.
Well, you know, I want to say I'm not beating up on this episode. I enjoyed watching it, but as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, it's hard to review the first third of a movie. As for Dark Side Ahsoka, when I saw that at the end of the Savage Press trailer, I mean, I'm sorry if you thought that that was going to be real, but come on. If you thought that in reality she was going to turn and become evil for anything beyond either dream sequence or mind control, then you haven't watched the same show I have for the past 2.5 years, because it's never going to happen. In the end, it's still a kid's show. She would not end an episode veiny and dark.
No, I was expecting something like she's under the influence of the Sith or something. She's turned into an agent of them and Anakin must save her, even if only within the span of a couple of episodes or something. Whereas here it seems like it's much more of an ethereal part of the whole Mortis, you know, force philosophy arc here. I didn't expect her to go dark and stay dark, but I expected it to be something that would have more consequence than what we're seeing here. I mean, this is a planet where things shift with the moods of the people who are living or trapped there. So, I don't know. I mean, what? Does she get too angry and she starts to look dark? Does she get tempted over by the sun? The vision's leading her in the wrong direction. I mean, there's still a lot of story potential to it, but I think there would have perhaps been more potential if she had done it on a different planet that didn't have the kind of baggage force-wise that this one does.
Well, for me, they caught me hook, line, and sinker when I saw the dark Ahsoka. I mean, I was drooling. I was like, oh, goodness. Because I'm thinking about the toys. I want a dark Ahsoka toy, action figure. And I guess I'm a little gullible because I did think that maybe this is the reason why we don't see Ahsoka in episode 3. And every time that something happens major with Ahsoka, they get me. Because I think this could be it. This could be it. Because after all, they are killing people. In this series, they just killed the Toydarian that we've seen come back time after time after again. And he was kind of a major character. Granted, he's not Ahsoka and he's not Anakin, but he has had conferences with Yoda and he has made some decisions concerning the whole Clone Wars. So in that aspect, when they do bring up things like this with Ahsoka, I fall for it every time, man, every time. But what I would like to see as this arc continues is I want them to explain a little bit more of how the father, the son, and the daughter actually came to be type of thing. Instead of we just kind of have to accept that they've always been here, I kind of wanted to delve back into that, like how did they become about? And maybe that could kind of segue into Anakin being around.
All right, we did get one little bit of information this week in line with the showing up of Qui-Gon Jinn in this episode. We found out that there's going to be a new Dark Horse series. It's going to be coming out in 2011. It's going to be 5 issues long, entitled Star Wars Jedi: The Dark Side, and it is going to be centering around the adventures or misadventures of Master Qui-Gon Jinn. It's taking place 21 years before the events of Star Wars Episode 1, and we can look forward to that starting May 18th. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Is this when Yoda still has a little bit of brown in his hair and he's just starting to go gray? Gray a little around the temple?
This is when Yoda was married to his first wife.
Wow. This actually looks like kind of an intriguing series because we have Jedi Master Tao, who is expected to be part of it. And we know, thanks to some descriptions that they have provided for us, that this is going to be delving into the era in which he had Xanatos as his Padawan. And Xanatos is the primary villain of the Jedi Apprentice series and at least part of the Jedi Quest series. So in a sense, we're getting a comic story that A, is about Qui-Gon, and we've barely seen anything like that before, but B, manages to tie together some of those Scholastic series that so many people have missed because they think, oh, it's a kid's book, when it's really actually a pretty good series. Repetitive at times, but a pretty good series.
All right. I do want to thank everyone for tuning in to listen to our discussion of Overlord. I also want to thank Arnie Barrett and Nathan P. Butler for joining me, and we all look forward to seeing you back here next week to talk about The Altar of Mortis. Good night, everyone.
Better than The Rigor of Mortis.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
And why is it that the only person that Dan always refers to by their full name is me?
Because it doesn't
refer
sound
to yourself
like
that
not,
way.
Hey, Nathan B. Butler.
I introduce myself that way so that people know who it is, but at the end of the episode, it's Nathan B. Butler. What do you think, Nathan B. Butler?
But it sounds weird any other way. I mean, you can't take the P out of Butler.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. It's like that's my first name, and of StarWarsFanWars.com is my last name.
We're here to talk about the latest episode, Overlords, first of another three-part trilogy. Joining me
first is a two-part trilogy or a four-part trilogy?
Shut up.
Or a trilogy of trilogies.
Wow.
You know Arnie's going to leave that in there now.
Of course he is.
I needed a blooper.
The first of another three-part story arc. And joining me this... All right, what the crap? Now, Arnie, I know it's been a while, so you don't remember how we do this, but
I'm just trying to add some fun. I'm trying to bring the funny.
Jerry would be so over me right now, Dan. You better do something.
All right, I'm muting myself.
Lord, boys. Is this what we get for not having the girl here to keep y'all in line? And she asks Nathan.
She asks Nathan, how does this fit into continuity? Why am I here?
Wow.
Now, we do have a preview for next week's episode, The Altar of Mortis.
And in next week's episode, I go, Nathan, that cannot be right. Oh, wait, you mean a preview of the TV episode, not our podcast?
Yes, that's what I mean. I don't mean necessarily a preview of next week's discussion.
Somebody will yell bingo, of course.
Arnie will make some obscure reference to an episode of Different Strokes or Family Ties.
Do you remember that episode of Bosom Buddies where Tom Hanks came out as the guy, as Hildegard? Well, that's kind of what this episode's like when we find out that Shmi is sister.
Oh.
Unlimited bosom.
There's your preview of next week's podcast.
Nice. All right. See.